This is Joshua S. Porter, and my book, With All Its Teeth, is out now. You can get a copy from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, Powell's, or wherever you prefer to buy books. For the next few weeks, I'm talking to artists and art enthusiasts about navigating the often treacherous intersection of faith and creativity. Christian Dawson is the pastor of worship at Bridgetown Church in Portland, Oregon. He and I are about to have a conversation about musical influences, what qualifies as worship music, and pushing up against church expectations with art. I remember one of the first conversations that you and I had. I was sitting on a couch in your office. So it was like the sitcom setup where, I don't know if you've seen that episode of Seinfeld where they can't sit in the booth and they have to sit at the bar and they can't communicate with each other. You've got this, I don't know if you still have it, but you had a couch along like the back wall of your office. So it's like the two of us side by side having a conversation. And I asked you what it was like to do worship at the church where you work. How's it going? What's it like? And you're like, well, I actually didn't get hired to be a worship guy. I came down here to do a different job. Been moved around a few times, and now I'm doing worship. And the thing that stuck out to me was that I was like, oh, okay. So do you like it? Did you want to do that? And you said something, I'm paraphrasing, but you said something to the effect of, well, when they asked me if I'd consider working, you know, primarily in a worship role, the first thing I said was, what if I want to do things differently than they have been done? And, you know, I don't mean to be reductive or anything, but at the time, the trajectory of worship aesthetics at the church where you worked and work had clearly been cut from a similar cloth to a lot of other big, I guess, rock band-based worship churches where the influence is like indie bands and down the timeline somewhere U2 and Coldplay.
Yeah.
Or something.
Somewhere clearly. Like, is there some dotted eighth delay and a lot of what reverb? Yep. All right.
Yep,
cool.
Here there it is. Yeah. And you were like, well, what if I want to do something that's like left of that center? Or what if I want to change things fundamentally? And I was like, oh, well, what'd they say? And you're like, well, I guess we're figuring it out. Then a bunch of time goes by, and I came to visit your church one morning just to be there, just to hang out. I didn't have anything to do. And you were leading worship. You were playing a digital piano. You were on the Nord in the front. And there was essentially a choir behind you. Yeah. And as I recall, no other musicians. There wasn't like a percussionist or anything. It was maybe like upwards of a half dozen people or something like that.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, this must have been the kind of thing that he, am I right? Is that the, did you envision that kind of change? Or is that already just like, oh, if it were completely up to me, I'd do it this way. But it's so far from anything like what has been done at this church before.
Partially. I mean, I don't know that I had just that specific vision. I mean, to be really candid, part of my question was not, I mean, just being a black man, I was like, not am I allowed to be here? Am I welcomed or will be trusted? Is more of like, when it's months in, am I really going to want to be followed as being a leader? Can I actually lead this as myself and show up? Because you can't do music and worship with it. It's part of, it's culture, it's music. So it's subjective and it's cultural as much as it is everything else that we do in the church. And so my question was really like, not do you want a black body or face, or do you like me personally, but like, will you actually let me lead? And can I go and do different things? Can I ask us to mix differently than we've mixed before? Can I do things, you know, different, not for the sake of change, but actually, cause I think there's different genres of music that impact people differently and, reflect God differently. And so, yeah, I mean, throwing a bunch of singers on the stage and letting it be a ton of harmonies and parts and letting me play, diminished chords and flat sevens, you know, and be in a key like B flat rather than G major, you know, it's like, it, yeah, that's part of it. But not everything in the totality, but yeah, that was one of the things.
So what's, is that your, well, I don't want to say, I get, these are probably two different questions, but your background as a musician, I'm assuming that you have a history. You didn't just suddenly learn how to sing and play piano. Yeah, right. So you have a background in music, but you also have aesthetic preferences. Are those kind of one and the same, or were you raised in a certain kind of aesthetic or around a certain aesthetic and then you found something?
Hmm. So I did music because of church. I mean, growing up, my dad would always have like gospel music playing on in the house. He did this like ghetto wired sound system that played in all the rooms in our house. So most nights it would be like smooth jazz in the night and people like Brian Culbertson. And then it'd be gospel music for most of the day, which normally meant we were like cleaning the house too. And so I was like, oh, gospel music's playing. It's Saturday morning. All right, grab the Windex, you know? So that always was like kind of in me. And then my grandma was a part of a African Methodist Episcopal Church. So like your kind of classic black church experience in Seattle where I grew up. But we went to a, non-denom, neo-charismatic Pentecostal mega church thing, you know, Hillsong-y music. But also my church was in a part of Seattle that was multi-ethnic enough where we just naturally sang like other genres of music. So our church would also be doing Israel Houghton songs. And then all the 90s, the 90s Hillsong stuff was also very like gospel influence or soft gospel influence of worship. Yeah. My dad played saxophone in our church. And so, you know, if that gives some like, so I just had different musical influences. And then my youth group though was, you know, the most of the people in my youth group were probably listening to your music and like Paramore. So, so I also grew up hearing all that stuff and appreciated a lot of that too. And so I don't know, I had a lot of different musical things that I enjoyed. And then I learned music because the church had a band teacher who was a Baptist minister who taught me how to play the piano. And so he was who I learned a lot of voicings from and heard that sort of stuff from. So I'm slowly losing the question, honestly. But
you came from a musical family.
A little bit,
like,
yeah.
Yeah, your dad mm-hmm. plays saxophone yep. and he had, you know, like music was a routine part of your home. I'm shocked, totally. Honestly, how often I meet peers of ours who will say, oh, I don't know what kind of thing I like. My parents weren't into music or they didn't play
that's
records
so weird.
For, you know, yeah.
No, or it's like people, I meet people now who tell me they can't sing and clap at the same time. And I've never even thought of that. Like you can't be singing words and clap on beat or clap at all. And I'm like, I guess that's yeah. some people.
Yeah. You find out if you try to lead a church in clapping quickly that,
oh no, we can't all do this. All right. Good to know.
But you have a wide enough palate. So you're, you know, kind of raised, in a musical family. You learned music as a young man,
mm-hmm.
And for church.
For church.
So that as you're learning, are you also like playing in worship bands?
Oh, all of it, man. I was putting in junior high and high school. I was easily putting in like 20 hours a week into worship stuff.
Wow.
I went to a private Christian school, which I was really fortunate. My parents worked really hard to put us in. And I was able to finish there. My brothers weren't, but I was, you know, at youth group on Wednesday nights. And I think there was a time we had two gatherings for a youth group. So I was doing worship twice on Wednesday night. Our school had, and then a Thursday night youth worship rehearsal. Our school had Thursday chapels. So I had like a rehearsal for that. And then Sunday morning. So I was just always working on music and playing and learning worship songs and writing in my bedroom and things like that.
And was the church and the school, did that have like kind of a wide spectrum of genres or was it more of the like 90s Hillsong stuff up front?
Yeah, still had the 90s Hillsong stuff. It was still, you know, guitar driven, all that. And then there were different musicians who did different things. And then especially when it came to like, you know, it was a mega church thing. So like every holiday, including 4th of July, there was like all this special music. So you'd like, so they'd be doing genre, like tons of different genres. We did this thing every year in the fall that was called like International Sunday, where we asked everyone in the church to wear, that weren't born in the U.S. to wear clothing from wherever their nation was. And mm-hmm. we'd sing music from different nations. And then at one point in the gathering, we'd have people, everybody who wasn't born in the U.S. to actually stand up and like, it would wrap the whole auditorium and we would, you know, hear every language that was spoken in our church. So there's enough, you know, people actually thought we were tokenizing our worship team because we'd have like Filipinos and Russians and like Hispanic, like all these people on the stage and people who thought we were like trying to tokenize it. And it was like, no, it's just actually our church. It was still, you know, predominantly white leadership, which, you know, was fine. But it was just enough to have different influences, even though I'd still say I didn't grow up in the black church. I just was influenced by that sort of music, as well as in college. I had a number of friends who were really close to Hispanic worship leaders. So that's where I kind of learned a little bit of Spanish. Not enough to like even talk to someone on the street, but enough to like fake being in church and like sing, like, you know, I could sing Santo and like do a little bit, you know. But I grew an appreciation even for like some Spanish worship culture, people like Marcos Witt and like, you know, things like that throughout childhood and then college years too.
Yeah, and I see you on Apple Music. You actually listen to worship music. Do you do that because your job is that you're a worship leader? That's do you funny. Actually enjoy putting on worship records and hearing them?
That's funny. Oddly enough, I don't love listening to singles, so I have a hard time right now with how music is in general, because everything's like the single thing. I'm like, no, write an album. Like, I want to hear where
I'm with you. Yeah.
You know, so I don't keep up. So it takes me forever to, and I want to just sit in the car and like listen to it. So like just when I have enough time and headspace where I'm not in traffic and angry to like sit and enjoy an album, it takes forever. And then so I normally only listen to music when I'm in the gym. And normally, because it's in the mornings, I don't normally listen to, which maybe we'd talk about this, but like I normally only listen to like worship music or just Christian music in the mornings, because I feel like my heart's pretty tender at the beginning of the day. Yeah. And then it's normally gospel music too, because musically it's just crazy and thought and beautiful and rhythmically like percussive and all this, which actually is kind of where I actually grew a little bit of love for some like hard rock and metal stuff, because of how percussive it was. It reminded me of gospel in a weird way, where I was like, whoever's writing these parts, it's like brilliant musicians who are doing both very similar sort of things, all these riffs and hits and like licks. Anyway, so I mostly listen to worship music just because I enjoy gospel music.
Yeah.
And it's impressive.
Yeah. And then so you have this, not just a wide aesthetic kind of palette of your own, but in an experience as well, because you're playing in school and in church, and you've grown up around different genres of music, and now you've been around like any of us. You know, you have some friends who like this kind of thing.
Yeah,
some
totally.
Friends who like this kind of thing. When you ended up where you are now, and you came into your position as worship leader, and you're conscious from the beginning of a desire to. Not, you know, I think that you put it well. It's not necessarily about like change for change sake, but to lead authentically as yourself, rather than kind of like, oh, do you want me to be this other guy?
Yeah. Who's great, but not me.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Did you feel a sense of, was there like palpable resistance is a strong word, but you know, you've got to turn a very big ship.
Yeah.
And having been there, a beautiful church and a beautiful collection of people, it seems to me, and maybe I'm totally off, but I could guess that maybe there'd be like even the first hints of like, wow, that's really different. That there might be like a palpable sense in the room of like, whoa, what are we doing? This is not the U2 band.
Yeah, right. I was like, yeah, sorry, y'all. I don't really play guitar, so I just actually can't help you. You know, I think it's a complex answer, man, because part of me's not sure. Like, part of me was kind of emotionally bracing for that, and it's easy to interpret certain experiences as, like, resistance, and I wasn't sure if that was just, like, because I was ready for that, or if it was actual curiosity. You know, I think the hardest part of all of it was less, like, I felt really trusted by the church, like, by the congregation in particular, and by our staff. Yeah. And, you know, truthfully, just because of the nature of the musicians that we had within our church and have within our church, it wasn't like I could do these massive musical genre shifts anyway, because, you know, people play the music that they know how to play, and they have the gear that they have, the gear, you know, they've all, everyone who's coming in and serving and playing has their own stuff. So I don't think there were these major, like, whoa, we're really going somewhere different. But there were little things, and, you know, there was a season actually a year ago where I felt really clearly like an invitation from the Spirit was to help our church understand that if we are, you know, music and worship forms us. I mean, I'm sold that it might be the greatest like formation tool that Christians actually have is songs. One of the top three, I'd say easily. And I think that we're not just formed by the words, but we're also formed by the way we say and sing and hear the words. And so, which is the crazy thing about musicians, like we actually have an odd amount of power to influence people's like even emotional landscape, and the way they think and hear and see, you know, the number of, anyway, I'm going down a tangent. So I think one of the things I experienced was some resistance, but I think it was less of like towards me. I think there were pieces of, as that adage, people aren't afraid of change, they're afraid of loss. And I think I experienced that where people were like, wait, if we do some things like this, are we losing this? And to me, I'm like, no, I still love the indie pop rock Lord meets Bethel meets we're changing up and we're special because we're using a drum pad, you know, yeah, thing. Yeah. And you're like, no, every church does that. Thanks, Hillsong Young and Free, you know? So like, so I think the more people realize like, no, we're not losing things, we're just gaining. And not only are we gaining, like, can we gain genres, but I think we can actually gain ways that we interact with God and then learn to know ourselves and learn to know our sisters and brothers in the room too. But no, I would say there was like some, if there was resistance, I think it was less overt and direct towards me. And it was more of the things I could kind of feel or the pushback I could see or the dragging feet, you know. Or sometimes like you'll experience things where, especially if you're kind of, to just contrast like CCM music, contemporary Christian stuff, to like more gospel influenced music, a lot of times musicians in the CCM space will say, well, that music's too busy, it's distracting. And that's the sort of subtle things that you kind of receive rather than flat out like, I hate this music. They're like, oh, it's distracting, it's too much for the congregation, it's not, you know. And I'm like, no, actually.
I like that answer. Yeah, that's something that I was curious about as well, because if it's not necessarily like a genre aversion, you know, where you come in and it's not like you threw out the kind of, I don't know, rich history of influences from your church. You just kind of added to them and steer it in a new direction. And yeah. You have other resources to and influences with which to color the aesthetic of the worship.
Yeah.
But in my experience personally, and you would know infinitely more about this than me, there is a certain kind of not just aesthetic expectation, but like ideological content expectation with which church people approach music and worship music in particular.
Yeah.
And that history, there's a sad history of it that goes all the way back to, you know, like the 80s and Amy Grant and, you know, where, well, it's not what Christian music is. Mm. And you would have think that we've outgrown a lot of these kind of sad, stunted expectations. But I find personally that in the same way that you mentioned the, you know, oh, well, you know, that's distracting, which is a strange subjective, like, ideological barrier to put it, like, well, totally. Who says what's distracting?
Totally,
because
right.
It's to you, like, I don't understand. Yeah. And if you paint outside of the lines of the kind of two or three worship conglomerates that we all accept as kind of leading the charge for worship sounds like this, and thankfully that has gotten a little wider with the, you know, rising popularity of a few different like genre fusions.
Yeah.
But even so, there's a little bit of like, oh, well, I don't know if that counts. And if you kind of steer left of always uplifting overtly Hosanna, Hallelujah,
right,
to something that is, you know, lament or something
totally.
That's a little more abstract, something that's a little opaque or strange. Across the board, just to the common Christian sensibility for Sunday morning, there's a sense of like, I don't know about this. Have you experienced that thing as well?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really fortunate. I think I'm fortunate that, you know, in the church that I'm a part of, there was actually a lot of space for lament. Ironically, I felt like our church, at least in the season I came in, had a harder time with joy and wonder. Just being in the city we're in, it's like, there was actually this sort of superiority to lament of lament to joy. That was like, well, we're being authentic and real. Like it, so anything that was joyful was actually suspicious because like the megachurch Christians are happy clappy or the prosperity gospel people like, but they're not real. And I'm like, yo, you go to my grandma's church and the announcements aren't an event to come to. It's about who's sick in the church. And it's about like making healthcare reform, because we're actually talking about like justice in the city. And it's typically like, you know, oppressed people socioeconomically, especially in the city. And they start singing, and you've never heard someone who can hold a group of people who can hold lament and wonder at the same time so well. So, you know, I think that was actually what caught me off guard more, was we'd actually be in moments where we're praying, God, would you help our worship be joyful? But then you'd like see the way the worship, the crew would like lead a song, or like the songs we choose. I was like, we're also just not setting ourselves up for this, you know? Sorry, I just went down that tangent, but I actually varied from your actual original question.
Well, I don't want to say shocks me, because it doesn't shock me. It makes perfect sense now that you say it. The, you know, that sense of like, oh, well, I don't know if this is the right worship for church. Mm-hmm. Now that's, in my experience, almost never what someone outright says.
No.
They infer, or they, you know, anytime you find something that's deviates from the formula that people have come to expect, there's a sense of like, oh, well, but is that church worship?
Right, you know? Right.
Or I've had, and sometimes with like great and empathetic intentions, you know,
totally.
I've had people, great worship leaders that I know and trust and work with, that I'll be like, well, what if we did this kind of thing on Sunday to, you know, suit the needs of the evening or whatever it might be? And they'll be like, well, but is that going to work? Is that good? Can you sing with that? Is that too abstract? Is it too wordy?
Yeah.
You know, and totally. I'm not saying that these concerns or considerations are always completely unfounded and we should just completely go off the rails, because you do, you know, like need to have a certain awareness of your people and the needs
and how
the
can they actually engage, that they actually still can engage in. But I even wonder if part of the problem is that even just using the word worship for everything we do, and maybe that's part of it, because there was a bit of my life where I stopped calling the time worship and I called it corporate music. Just because I'm like, some of what we do is worship, but some of it isn't. If we're meaning the strict sense, and I don't mean in the like broad sense of like all of life is worship, but like in terms of like upward adoration towards God and like honor, worship, what, like in that sort of strict sense, then yeah, there's a number of things we sing that aren't worship songs. And I think they have a great purpose in the church. So part of me almost always like advocates that like we call our time like music. Because you're right, some things aren't worship, but our job isn't only to worship when we gather. Our job is ultimately is or to worship in that way when we gather. Yeah. So I think there's actually space for different forms of art that would call us to reflect or lament or to be still or to be, you know, there's all these other things that we can do, and that's just with music, let alone like visual art, for example. I wonder if part of the pushback is that from people is that we actually have too low of a view of what we're supposed to do with corporate music in a gathering space.
Yeah, totally. What are some of the things that you think are healthily deviate from the very good and very necessary practice of the upward praise and worship in the mm-hmm. true sense, like, but still involve music and singing and words? Like you mentioned a couple of them, stillness and reflection.
Yeah, even with singing and lyric choice, I mean, you get to Paul in Colossians and he talks about singing songs to one another, not just to God, but actually like encouraging one another through songs. Paul also in Corinthians talks about like songs being like having a prophetic nature too, where you actually can like quote unquote, and I don't know the science behind it, but like prophesy through song, not just, and you actually see that with even Saul, where there were musicians, there were musicians and prophets who were prophesying through music, and the Spirit of God came on Saul. So, I mean, clearly there's a form of like Paul had a framework in the scripture as a framework for encouragement, exhortation over one another, which makes me think of songs. You know, there's a lot of songs that actually call us to like hope in the Lord. That's not a song of worship to God. That's actually a song that I'm singing to remind my soul to hope in God and to remind like my sisters and brothers around me that they can hope in God. And so, I mean, that's a thing we can do we can, of course, like lament is one that I actually learned a lot from being in spaces like this that I didn't grow up in, that didn't teach me how to lament in the same way. And that's been helpful to learn. You know, I also wonder about, calls to faithfulness. Like there's a number of songs that aren't worship, but they're actually like resolutions. Like I resolve to live this way, to be this sort of people. Myself and the former worship pastor wrote a song that basically that it's not a song upward. It's a song that's like calling out the idols of our age and our time and our moment and resolving to live differently and to follow the way of Jesus. And it's not a worship song and it doesn't give you like any of the Jesus goosebumps, you know, or like, oh man, that really hits the spot and feels good. No, it's a song for Monday morning. And like, for me, it was really cool. This summer I got the privilege to not lead worship as much and just like watch our other worship leaders lead and kind of get to be on the other side and coach. And then I spent most Sunday mornings, outside the church greeting, and the number of kids that came up to me, cause we're fortunate to have like kids be part of the, singing and music up front. And so I had a number of kids who never get to interact with me because they leave to class by the time I'm coming off the stage, who, came up to me and they would tell me the songs that they like, that we sing. And a number of them weren't the upward songs. There's this one song that we sing that says, you know, make my heart a cathedral, make my soul a temple, make my life an altar where your fire falls. And it has this melody line that like jumps an octave and is really loud and the kids must love it just because they feel like you're screaming. But I was like, whoa, that's getting into that kid's heart, hopefully, like that they're actually the temple of God. Or another, or that song I was referring to earlier that says like, I just want to be like Jesus. So take my life, steer it. And I'm like, whoa, what is it like for a 5-year-old to sing, take my life and steer it however you see fit? Or earthly things will make me hollow. Like there's other purposes. They're not upward, but they're actually calling us into a life following God. And I'm curious. One other nerdy thing that I think is interesting is like when you read Jesus, the passion narratives, most of the things that are happening specifically on the cross, but even right before it are, like Psalm 22 to Psalm 30 or like 31 or something like that. And I mean, you read Psalm 22 and it's like shockingly almost like exactly what's happening. But if you keep going through, the things Jesus says are actually in those Psalms, like, my God, why have you forsaken me? And into your hands, I commit my spirit. And I'm curious if Jesus, was going through the Psalms in his mind during the passion. Like if while he was in the court, not answering a word, or in front of Pilate, or carrying the cross, or like up on there, part of me just like wants to imagine that Jesus was just praying through the Psalms that he knew, the songs and the prayers of his day to music and just that were read aloud. And like he's getting stabbed and he's almost singing like words of the songs of his day and the Psalms of his day. And I'm just curious, like maybe there's something to that.
Writing a book is hard, but publishing one is harder. Whether or not things go well and I get to write more books is sort of up to you. If you care about that sort of thing, here's a few ways you can really help. One, buy a copy of With All Its Teeth. Buy a copy for someone you think might like to read it. There's a free small group study guide at joshuasporter.com. You can host a get-together and have everyone buy a copy. Two, tell other people about the book. Post about it on your social media outlets, text a friend, bring it up at a dinner party. Three, leave With All Its Teeth a good review on Amazon.com. Leaving a review is fast, free, and easy, and goes a long way in supporting the book. Four, listen to this With All Its Teeth podcast miniseries and leave it a good review on the Apple Podcast app. This helps other people find the podcast, which helps other people find the book. And finally, five, you can follow my social media accounts for updates on the book, the podcast, speaking engagements, and more. Following accounts may not seem like a big deal to you or me, but the industry suits care about that sort of thing. Anyway, those are a few ways you can help. Buy the book, tell other people about it, leave a good review on Amazon and the Apple Podcast app, and follow along for more updates. The song that you guys wrote is a fantastic example of that. Yeah, I guess that it might fit and worship in like as a genre tag on a streaming service.
Totally.
But it's not like God is great kind of song. Mm-hmm. It's actually kind of a self-examination.
Yeah.
And it just consistently repeats a desire essentially yeah. throughout the chorus. Like, this is what I want. I want to be like Jesus. I just want to be like him. And the first time I heard you play that song, it was a stripped down version, and it was like in a kind of conference setting with a bunch of pastors. And there's a line in the song where you say, "Christ alone gives joy on earth."
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like the punchline of the whole song. It's just the conclusion of like verse two or
yeah,
something. And the room kind of erupted as a reaction to that line in the context of its, you know, of that verse. And I was like, oh, wow, that was a really cool, powerful thing to, it was almost like a consensus in the room. There was an agreement, you know, like the shouting was the amen moment. But even that, in the context of the song, that Christ alone brings joy on earth, is not like upward in the sense that it's like God, you bring it.
Yeah.
It's the narrator of the song,
right,
is in a moment of reflection, and the narrator is kind of presenting the case for wanting to be like Jesus.
Totally.
Because I've learned that this is the only thing that will actually bring joy.
Yeah.
And I wondered about writing that song, because you said you wrote it with Matt Ziganis, right?
Yeah. So I had written most of the words before I even moved to Portland, actually. I think I had been listening to a podcast series or something, and just some themes in my own life. And so I wrote the words, which is way more my sweet spot than like melody and music. And, but I gave it to him. I was like, yeah, do you have ideas for this? And then he held some ideas of like how to change things to fit melodically. And he's such a brilliant writer and good dude and friend. But he helped, like the chorus, I think, was originally more complex, and he made it way more like melodically pretty and punchy. And so I probably would say Matt did the music and I did more of the words.
Oh, came out great. And it sounds, honestly, I don't mean to be presumptuous, but it sounds like a song that you guys, you know what I mean? Like, it sounds like a co-written song. And it sounds like the overlap of these two eras of worship.
Unintentionally, because we were doing that before he had any plans to leave, and I had zero plans to be in that position. So it's an interesting thing that happened. And even the musical overlap was interesting, because I would never have written a melody like that. I think the chorus has this, like, the first line of the chorus is always in a three bar, and I would just never think like that, because I think, like, it doesn't groove with some of the music I know, and it just works. People love it. But then if there's the end of the song actually refrains like one of the verses, but it changed, all the chord progressions changed to this like chromatic kind of more soulful thing.
Yeah.
It's my favorite part of the song, because I wanted people to hear the same words and even the same, almost exact same melody, but with a different chord structure. Cause I think it crescendo's not the right word, but I think it closes the song helpfully.
It does. It's a fantastic example of the way a chord phrasing shifts the tone.
Totally.
Yeah, because there's this help me not to live distracted, which we've already sang it at this point in the song. It refrains, but the chording changes, and it's almost like a visceral sounds really strong, but there's an internal reaction.
I go out of key on purpose.
Yeah,
on that,
and you're like, ooh, what, what's that? And that stuck out to me the first time I heard it as like the most memorable part of the song, and communicative. Like going back to what you said about like music, and you, I think, said that intentionally, not just lyrics. Music is one of the most formative resources that we have as disciples of Jesus and as human beings.
Totally.
The music is what makes that moment land the way it does, as a bedding beneath the line. The line's great. We've heard the line before, but that moment kind of, it feels to me almost like a solidification of like, it's concluded. This is the conclusive moment
of
the song. So I'm wondering if how wide do you go for influences artistically? I'm assuming that, you know, you're a lyricist, you're a musician, and you lead worship. It stands to reason that you're probably drawing from peers for influence, you know, like, oh, this church does that. That's kind of cool. We could do something like that. But do you go beyond not just Christian music and lyrics, but music and lyrics and to other kinds of art? Do you, you know, you and I have talked about movies a bunch. Do you like when you're in a place of like writing, whether it's lyrics or music, are you drawing from things that you've been, that moved you in a film or something that you've read, something that you've seen? Because something that you said to me when I asked you about doing the podcast was that you said that your art is very Christian. And
yeah.
I think that that, it didn't surprise me, but I like it. I think that's, it's awesome because I don't know you to be, the kind of person who is, shall we say, sheltered or culturally closed off.
Yeah, you know what I mean?
And you appreciate these other modes and forms of art. Do those things inspire? What's something that like has been inspiring to you that someone, I don't know, might surprise someone or?
Oh yeah. Well, normally with music, I love a good vocalist. So I'm like, if the music good, but the vocals, like the music has to be banging for me to like listen through it. If I like don't like the vocalist or like, it's okay. So that's normally a just thing for me off the bat. Like if I hear someone good, like who can sing and the music's trash, I'll still enjoy them. I'll still really enjoy it. I was like, wow, just the vocalist, something about that always gets me. Even, I just watched that new Hunger Games film. Mm-hmm. And you know, when you're watching a movie and they like break out in song in a moment and you're like, you can just hear like, and we went from this audio to the studio, like you can just hear the mic, everything just changed. And you're like, as music, like I just can't unhear it in the studio. Now I'm like watching a person lip sync and I'm so aware of it. And when I watched the Hunger Games film, I was like, whoa, they did this. They did this pretty dang well.
There's
like
a song number in the new Hunger Games?
There's a lot of singing. There's a lot of music in it. Wow. It's a huge theme of this prequel movie that just came out. And the girl who acts sang for it, and she, yeah, I was like, whoa, what's happening here? So even that, like, but a lot of the music was folk. It was like this kind of it felt very backwoodsy, somewhere between like almost like the Get Fiddle Banjo like stuff that I'm like, but something about it just felt so, it just felt good. And I don't know that music at all. So I would never be able to write. I don't think I would naturally write anything like it, but it just was really cool. But I think truthfully, and probably because I preach some, I think of music and I think of even preaching those art forms. Like I think of good TV shows or movies. Like I really like watching TV and, just like, how do you make something arc really well? And yeah. Like, that's even how I think of worship leading. Like most moments where I'm like in a gathering watching, a worship thing happen, where I was trying to not say worship set, but because it just feels really cheap. I was like, yeah, you know what I mean? Like more charitable, blah, blah, blah.
Yep.
But I was like, most times and I'm like, oh, when you feel like things are kind of floundering or it's just awkward or weird or like a moment was lost, it's for me, I'm always like, man, if they thought about this like a movie, they would like, how do you hand the baton? How do you like, what's happening in the room? What do you, you know, that sort of stuff. So I think I subtly pay attention to TV and movies, they actually really inform the way I think and lead worship, because I know the moments where I'm like, man, we lost the moment, you know, and the opposite too, where you had me, like,
yeah,
you had me
totally.
And how do I hold? And that's part of my job is like, how do I bring everybody to the same place, and then from there see where we can go. And I think cinema actually helps me learn how to do that.
Yeah, that makes sense. I've been in a room before on a couple different occasions where a team of folks that includes you are trying to best think through how do we consciously lead people through a series that's coming up on a mm-hmm. given Sunday. And I've heard you a couple different times ask questions or for clarity around those things. And it's clear to me, it's like, oh, he's thinking of the whole picture.
Yeah,
you know,
totally.
Know what I mean? It's like, well, if we're doing that at that point, then how are we going to get to this point? Because you're thinking of it, narratively is the wrong word, but you're thinking of, yeah. I think the Arkwell idea that you brought up a minute ago, you know, which makes me wonder, you know, I'm sure you're aware, having a background in church, and having, you know, a background in like charismatic worship and experience around different, even non-denominational, but with, you know, different expressions of worship and stuff.
Yeah.
There are churches that go, and I don't mean this pejoratively about any of them. I just mean objectively, there are churches who like kind of go all in on a big show, shall we say, a big experience. Mm-hmm. And then there are churches who are, and Christians, who are extremely reticent to anything that feels like pageantry.
Yeah,
you know?
Totally.
And there's like a sense of the thing that I think a lot of us hear all the time is like it feels exploitative or hypey, mm-hmm. or as if you're trying to curate an experience or force an emotional experience.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've had people ask me, good-naturedly, ask me, like, oh, I don't know about this certain aesthetic decision that we've made in church, because it feels like we're trying to curate an emotional experience. And I've often answered by being like, we are.
We are, absolutely.
We are. So that was my question. What school of thought do you...
Absolutely. Well, I think, I mean, the question is, what makes something... manipulative, I think, is what people are trying to get at. Like, mm-hmm. we shouldn't manipulate. But I think the idea, but part of that, to me, and this is my uncharitable assumption, a lot of times when you're like, well, you're trying to manipulate people, and I am trying to form people. I do think we listen to a lot of sermons and podcasts and read a lot of books because we think we need to help people learn how to think, you know, period. Jesus did a lot of teaching because he thought the way people thought wasn't actually always true and right and good. And I think the same thing about our emotional worlds. I think most of my problems, because, oh man, I'm so many things. Like, most of my problems with people aren't because they actually are stupid. It's because more times than not, actually, like, we don't know how to navigate our inner world, especially our emotions. And most humans don't make decisions based off what's the quote unquote, like, just true thing. It's like, I'm a person with family of origin and trouble, all this sort of stuff. So like, we're constantly having to reshape how we feel. And so I think even as worship leaders and musicians, when we're doing what we're doing, we actually should help people learn how to feel rightly. Mm-hmm. And like, Jesus critiques, I mean, like, I think some of his critiques with even the Pharisees were like, you're feeling the wrong thing with this sort of person. Like, it's judgment when it should be compassion. Like, Jesus is actually getting at their inner world and their emotional world. And so even through music, like, there's moments where our church actually needs to learn how to, just to use one extreme, is like, be sad. Like, this is sad. And another moment is like, we need to learn how to be joyful. And I think the idea of like, if it's not like, I'm not going to do it if it's not authentic, is actually so deformational for Christians.
Yeah.
Because if we all did that with the way we think, I mean, like, if I just lived the way I authentically thought, my life would cause a lot of havoc and hell on people. And I would do a lot of things that are out of the way of Jesus. I think the same is true with our emotional world. If we are always true to our emotions, and I think what we should do is be aware of our inner world and our emotional life. And then from there go, now Jesus, like, how do I emote rightly? And what is even true versus, like, even my therapist says, like, all feelings are real, not all feelings are true. And so, like, often I'm like, yeah, I'm really feeling this thing, but like, I'm not understanding it correctly. And so anyway, even with aesthetic in church, I've been to church gatherings where you can tell they put tens of thousands of dollars into lighting design, and it really helped me engage more. And like, for some reason, when the room was blue while we were singing this song, like, I focused and like, I could, you know, versus when the room was like orange and things were like, I actually felt, because color, I mean, McDonald's gets that. Like, they have people who have whole degrees in how to color things properly for rooms to note, to cater your experience. So can the church do that? Yeah. The problem is when like lighting is an end in itself, when, and truthfully, there's a lot of churches who spend a lot of money and do a thing and it's just, it's again, distracting, but it doesn't help me like get to the right end goal. And it takes away from the ends rather than being a means. And I think that's where the moment you're like, okay, is this helping serve the actual means? And how do we, what questions can we ask to actually do that? But I've worshiped with, you know, in rooms and spaces where it was just, you know, whatever gym lighting was in the room. Yeah. And that was awful. Like, it was actually really hard to focus too. So like, we can rag on both sides of it and both be really worshipful and both be not. And I've heard good arguments for both, you know, sides of the,
yeah,
of that stuff.
Yeah. Minimalism is an aesthetic. Maximalism is an aesthetic. I think it's interesting that there are Christians who are fans of fill in the blank, you know, mm-hmm. pop or rock star, that, you know, a friend of mine went to see Beyonce on this last tour, mm-hmm. and she was regaling me with her experience of like, apparently it's like over the top production.
It is. Yeah. She's wild.
Yeah. And she was just like, it was this and it was this. And I was like, man, that sounds amazing. It sounds like it was, you know, for her, it was like this immersive, emotional, yeah. artistic experience where she was just like, and as a fan, obviously critics are going to say something differently. But as a fan, I don't think that she would say, man, this was inauthentic because it had, had backup. She understood all of that as an immersive aesthetic that was designed to bring the audience into a shared
experience.
Yeah. And even like a, I mean, these words sound really over the top, but transcendent or spiritual experience of the music. But then, and a lot of us, if we're fans of that thing, you know, the people who saw, I don't know, U2 in that bubble in Las Vegas or something the videos online and everything, they're like, man, this looks incredible. If you can concede that like, wow, these like, I guess attention to detail and concern for pageantry enhanced an experience more so than if there hadn't been a million backup dancers and people coming down from the ceiling. Like that. And but then for some reason we expect that church, for in order for it to be authentic, has to dispense with aesthetics and pageantry altogether. You know,
right? Which I mean, if you just think about the cathedrals in Europe for however many centuries of church history, of that part of church history in that part of the world. I mean, they were the most ornate buildings in the world, most expensive buildings in the world for their time, where, I mean, they didn't have the same like electricity where they could do LEDs, but you know, you imagine what it, the money and the time and the artistry to nail stained glass or to like build these cathedrals and chapels and paint these sort of and like design them facing a certain direction so this I mean they were thoughtful designing it so the sunlight would catch at certain hours and dot it like and so the people could hear the voices versus and you have the dome shapes that are supposed to kind of embody like heaven meeting earth versus like the pointed up like all these sort of things. I mean it's it was the I would you could make a pretty easy case around being a similar equivalent because they thought it was worth every money to help form people because especially when you're talking about a part of the world that was very illiterate at the time, you didn't form people through giving them books. You formed people through architecture and you formed them through songs. So I think they're onto something that they, again, I'd probably maybe say like, maybe sometimes these conversations are starting at too low of a view of art and architecture and design and things like that and music than too high of a view.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. And you know, the last thing I wanted to ask you, it is something that I didn't prepare beforehand. It's something that came to me when you mentioned earlier that, you know, you believe in, like I said, I agree that music, and, you know, by association art is one of the most important resource, one of the most powerful formative resources that we have as disciples of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that, I don't know if this is something that you've ever had to think through, but I'm sure you've met or known people who are, now I'm going to offend somebody, but you and I are album guys. We established that earlier. Mm-hmm. We appreciate the album experience. But you know, we are now in the culture of the single, which is a consumable, disposable, you know, the idea of there are lots of people who have nothing but singles on there. They don't, and they only know an artist by the single to them. It's like a, you know, it's like Happy Meals.
Happy Meals.
And if you have this kind of like art is only entertainment view of art or music specifically, then it's probably harder for you to wrap your mind around the idea, you know, in practice. Maybe there are experiences that break through, but in practice that God cares so much about this thing he made up, music, that it's one of the primary ways that he will shape and form you in your life. So if you know, if you have the person in your life who's just like, eh, you know, like it's kind of expendable to me. The thing that I am asking myself all the time is like, how do we form people in the spiritual discipline of art appreciation? And you take someone who's like, oh, I actually couldn't care less about music. And tell them like, you kind of need to.
Yeah,
because God does. God cares about it.
Wow, that's actually beautiful. I've never heard someone say that so directly. Yeah, I'm like curious, like people who don't care about it. I'm like, what? It's like the people who can't sing, can't sing and clap at the same time. I don't want to make up. I'm just actually thinking about what you just said.
And you're a guy who that's like, I don't know, livelihood sounds like crass, but I mean, like, this is your vocation,
yeah.
You know, to do music and worship and to preach. All of those are creative endeavors. And when someone is like, oh, I can kind of take it or leave it. I think that that's an idea a lot of us have, or a lot of people have bought into, and they think ultimately, well, why is it, what does it really matter to advocate for all these different intricacies in art? Because ultimately we don't really need it, do we? Like, we've got the Bible, and you're like, you know, you do realize the Bible is a work of art, right?
Yeah. You know? Like, you mean a book of creative literature that took maybe the longest book to ever like be completed, and, you know, or series of books ever being completed in human history. Like, yeah, you know, the thing that's coming to my mind, and I bet when I leave here, I'll think of something that would have been more profound and make me sound a lot better. But the thing that's just quick coming to my mind now is I wonder if there's just like a weird assumption there that like we're thinking things as human beings, or like it's just assuming like we just need one form of interacting with the world or one sense. But I'm like, man, haven't you had like a really good meal? Like, what's your favorite thing to eat? That's something it does in your senses. And I think what art does at its best, maybe not at its best, that might sound too extreme, but what I think one of the best things that art can do is grab us in our senses in such a vivid way, like a good meal or the colors of a sunset that you're just like, I've never seen a painting be able to grab. Like, just, it can't do it. Every time my mom grabs her phone during a sunset, I'm like, yeah, you're like, however many, you know, megapixels is not,
the picture's just not going to translate.
It's never going to translate into what the human eye somehow, even that, it's like, whoa, that my eyes can see things that like my iPhone screen just still can't really capture and get the color, like just that diff. And I think art, what it's always intended to do is like, it's supposed to connect like gift to giver. You know, and I think at its best, you said transcendent. You go to a Beyonce show and sometimes you're like, I feel like that. I remember I did go to one of her shows once and there was this weird moment that happened unintentionally. It was in Seattle and she was singing a thing and it started raining. She just sang through the rain, singing the song. And then like she had like, I think confetti had gone off and like a gust of wind hit like towards the end of the song. And it was like it grabbed all the confetti and swirled it in some weird way when the band was, it was like this, it's like, what just happened? Sort of thing. Or I remember hearing, being at a Jacob Collier show once, years ago, it was like like 30 people in the room and he wasn't big. And I just went and he was playing this thing and he like designed his music software with this video screen to like the art would come onto the screen based on what he played in the intervals. Like it was this whole thing that was, I remember sitting there and like, I couldn't help it. Like a tear dropped from my face. And I was like, I'm not normally the guy who cries quickly, not even because of stuffing. I'm just how I'm wired, I think. But I just was like, just moved. And, or like being in those immersive Van Gogh experiences. I got to do that with my wife a year or two ago. Anyway, I think at their best, those moments, or when you're having a really good meal and you're just like, whoa, these flavors. Like, have you had like good curry? Like good curry? Like there's certain things that it awakens a thing in you that at its best it connects gift to giver. And I think we're missing it if we don't catch that. Like when I hear a song and I'm wowed at the complexity of this musician and this gospel lick and the way they did this chant, blah blah blah. And like I can appreciate it, but like in the best moments I'm like, and to think we have a God who can take something so individual, like a single instrument or a single note, and also weave it together with all these other instruments and notes. I'm like, man, in my best moments, it actually should remind me of what God can do with my life and how God can find resolution through diminished chord, or how the variance between different yellows and oranges in a sunset, like God can get so specific and accurate that it's moving. Yeah, I'm just curious if like I'm missing it more times than I mean, I'm not even curious now. Now that I'm talking, I miss it more times than not. I miss what art is supposed to do and what it can do in me, and not just something I consume or enjoy, which I think is most of the problem with a lot of the worship stuff too, is like we're just consuming it. But it's even that is a means, you know, it's a means to a greater end, which is supposed to connect us back with God. So maybe that's what we're missing, and Maybe I feel like, man on my drive, I maybe just want to pay attention more to even these gray days in our city that all the colors feel muted, but maybe there's a story there that maybe it's supposed to remind me of something about the human story that I can actually remember.
I'm Joshua S. Porter, and if you'd like to support me or my writing, you can buy a copy of With All Its Teeth wherever you buy books. Tell other people about it, leave a good review on Amazon, and leave a good review of this podcast on the Apple Podcast app, and follow along on social media for more updates. The songs I used in this episode were 1 Ghosts 1, 7 Ghosts 1, and 9 Ghosts 1 by Nine Inch Nails.